Hi, it's Lucy, and welcome back to another episode of The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I put a spotlight on the women shaping the world of cinema today. In today's episode, we're joined by Ruby Phelan, an inspiring filmmaker who began her journey as a dancer, choreographer, and actor before finally stepping behind the camera as a director. We'll be exploring her recent short film, The Woman in the Wardrobe, a moving story about a woman giving birth in the middle of a war zone. Ruby collaborated with the UNFPA to provide birthing kits to women in need, which shows how art and activism can come together to make a real difference. I hope you really enjoy this conversation, and thank you for listening. Hi, Ruby. Nice to meet you. Thanks so much for reaching out to me anyway about this podcast. It's really nice of you, and I'm glad we finally found a moment. I usually ask my guests about, you know, how they got started out in the industry, and reading about you and learning about your beginning of your career is really interesting. I saw that you trained as a professional dancer and a choreographer and also as an actor before you moved into film. So yeah, I'd love you to tell me a bit more about that, your background in dance and choreography and acting, and how this sort of shaped, if at all, like your approach to storytelling now as a director.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, yeah, I began dancing, and I danced, you know, since I was 3 years old. So I really very much kind of just jumped straight into that area, and I instantly was kind of intoxicated by it. And was at 3 years old, I think I turned around to my mum and I was like, I want to be a professional dancer. Like, that's what I want to do.
Wow. Ambitious from a young age.
Yeah, she was just like, oh, okay. But very, yeah, incredibly determined to go into the arts from a very young age, and just did absolutely everything and did every type of dance that you could kind of lay your fingers on. But I then, as I got older, I started to, I think probably quite dissatisfied with the lack of creativity from like a dancer's position, just because I'd done it for so long and I just needed something a bit more meaty, I think. So I think choreography for me felt like it was something that I could start pulling other artistic things into. So I just loved acting, I loved storytelling. So I was like, okay, well, my medium is through dance, so how can I tell stories through dance? And I still, you know, I was working as a dancer as well, so I went to dance school in the north of England, you know, when I was like 16 17, and I moved up there, and then whilst I was there and I was training as a dancer, I also had access to a lot of other dancers as well. So I started to make my own company, and I started to do choreography pieces, but they were really, really narrative, and they were also really drawing upon, like, I was really interested in the lighting, and I was very interested in where the audience was positioned and how they were like watching the piece, and the music and the vibe of it and the costumes. And I was basically just directing films, but through dance, and didn't really know that that's what I was doing. And then I had kind of this secret love affair with Shakespeare in my bedroom when I was at dance school, and I was reading like a lot of, yeah, Shakespeare plays whilst I was there, and just secretly wishing that I could play these characters, that I had the permission to be able to play these characters. A lot of the male characters, actually. I really wanted to play the meaty male characters. I wasn't really interested in the female characters. I wanted to rewrite the female characters, but play the male characters.
Right.
So then I went to drama school in France, because I was like, I need words. I've had all of this training and movement, but like, there's something missing, and it's words. Like, I need to speak. I need my voice to be heard. And then when I was at drama school, I did exactly the same thing that I did at dance school, where I started to fall into the directing space of...
You like to be able, like, to take a bit more control, maybe, of what's going on.
I think, ultimately. I'm very controlling. But I think artistically... I think that I'm artistically just... There's an instinct there that I kind of know how something needs to be, just from my own perspective, where I just want a bit more. I think as a director as well, it's really lovely because, you know, I can also, because I've had that experience as a performer, I can very much be comfortable stepping into actor space as well, and really getting I wanted to say like down and dirty, but like really kind of, you know, getting
to the nitty gritty sort of things.
Yeah, getting into the nitty gritty of the process, and really not being afraid to discuss, you know, deep craft with my actors.
Yeah, because you've been on both sides, so you can see from both perspectives. But I was also going to say about like, sorry to interrupt, but you were saying about choreography and everything, and I mean, essentially that's telling stories with the body, isn't it? So now it feels like maybe a natural shift into directing, because you've been telling stories with the body, and now you're, I mean, it's body, like a lot of filming and acting is body language and telling stories through the movement as well. So there's a lot of that goes on. So you probably could easily, like, what did they call them? Like transferable skills, like from one job to the other.
It's very funny where it, I think that's so true, and thank you for saying that, but it's very funny where it rears its head, like my past experience, where those transferable skills come from, because I actually find in editing, I suddenly go, oh, okay, I understand this, because it's all about rhythm. It's all about, you know, and then when I'm working...
Yeah, editing, like, definitely. It's like a rhythm.
Yeah, when I'm working with sound department, I'm like, oh my God, this is just in my soul because it's music. Like, I know how that needs to work with picture. And I feel like everything has really come from that source of dance. And I'm so great. I think in the past, like when I went into acting, I was like trying to like push my past down and kind of be like, no, I'm not the dancer. Like, I don't want to be that. But now I'm so proud of that, because as you say, I think that it's, you know, telling stories with the body. And I think that that's been very obvious in this piece as well, is that telling stories with the breath and with the body, and like these internally epic tales, that was all explored for me when I was in dance, because I was also like as a dancer going through that as well. You know, I'd have these kind of visions inside myself, and I had to find a way to be able to bring them outside of myself through my movement, and through then imparting my movement into other people's bodies as well. And so it's like now as a filmmaker, it's about, you know, conjuring stories inside my head, conjuring visions inside my head, and then communicating those to my teams, to people around me in the best way that I possibly can. So I do a lot of my stuff is obviously through script writing, but then also I have like I love concept art, so I have a lot of concept art. I also do a lot of...
What do you mean by
myself,
concept art? So. Sorry, I feel like... I probably should know what this is, but...
I work with a concept artist who basically, he does... So for the woman in the wardrobe, we did about 6 frames where he just like drew... He was one of the first people that I spoke to about the project, apart from obviously my producer and my executive producers, but with, yeah, like an outside eye, drew scenes from my script, and that just helped us to then communicate to the wider team.
So like storyboarding a little bit?
No. Kind of like storyboarding, yeah, but just less, I guess less, I spoke to him about it being almost like pillars or like totem poles that we use to kind of scaffold the piece. So it wasn't like we had, you know, a scene and we were like, okay, we're going to go from this shot to this shot to this shot. It was more just, these are 6 images which kind of span the whole thing, but they represent the vibe, the visual vibe piece. And sometimes, like, I know that he does concept art for other people as well. He will just do like one big picture from one scene which kind of just encapsulates one scene, or like he does like more formalized storyboarding as well, which would just be more frames. But I do a lot of that. I feel like I try and work very closely with like really tangible visual things as well, to just be able to like communicate the vision in the most succinct way possible to all departments. And I love giving, like, I do very, basically I just do very in-depth research in all areas,
like a mood board.
Yeah, anyway. Like we did, I mean, I did like a big mood board for everybody, which kind of, I guess, yeah, as I said before, like just encapsulated every single different part of it, so that everybody had like a brief to go from, somewhere to spring off from. And then they usually will send me back stuff, and then I'll send something back. So it's just like this conversation, just keep going back and forth with references, and love big Pinterest boards. And just
I
as
love
many
Pinterest.
Yeah, merged Pinterest boards are the best as well, when you get like your other collaborators on to the merged Pinterest board, and you can just go back and forth with images. But I think that yeah, it's just a, it's exactly the same process as what I was doing before with my choreography and with my dancing and with my acting, but it's just now just so right. Like I was always heading to this place, but I didn't know it. I didn't even know that. I genuinely, when I was younger, probably I would say 10 years ago or something, if you'd asked me like what I would be doing right now, this would not have been
part of the plan.
I would have never ever thought that I was going to be a film director. Like that would have never come into my, and I remember even like when I was training as a director, because I went to RADA to train as a writer-director, and even when I was there, I was like, I remember saying, like, I can't write dialogue, like, that's not, I'm not really a writer, and now you can't stop me writing, I can't stop writing dialogue now, and it's
that's
just
great.
So funny, because I feel
like opened up that part of you.
Yeah, definitely, and I think it's actually other people around me who have probably made me feel and allowed me to know that my voice, I think as a woman, I think that these are so, there's so many barriers and hurdles that I've had to jump just within myself, being like, my voice is legitimate, people want to hear what I have to say. There's also, you know, especially with this film, I think because it's about birth, it's, you know, in wider culture, because I've worked, so my mum is a midwife and I've worked on the maternity ward, so mm-hmm. I have this attitude, especially with like the NHS and with hospitals and stuff, that like birth is hidden away, but birth is like taken away from us. It's put in a corner. It's put into a different space. Mm. Women's reproductive rights are not really talked about unless you're with other women. Mm. And it's kind of this secret taboo that we all talk about, but it doesn't really get, you know, put into wider culture, and especially not on screen. It's always like part of a montage, or it's something that's really vile and quite, a lot of the time, very cliche, but it's most of the time it's a woman lying on her back screaming and having a doctor pull a baby out of her vagina.
Yeah.
And
pretty much I'm thinking of like what comes to mind is like Friends or something, like Rachel or and it's sort of being more of a comedic kind of situation than anything.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that I've had a life of sitting with my mum for a very long time, my mum who is a midwife, and sat with her and watched a lot of films and a lot of TV and just heard like a lot of kind of midwifery criticism around the depiction of birth. And then also the other thing is when I went and worked on the maternity ward, you know, I've watched a lot of birth scenes in cinema and then I got to the unit and it was just so different to what I'd experienced when I'd, and I was like, wow, we're being, I don't know, just from a feminist perspective, I was like, we're being tricked. Like, it's not like, it's just, this is so, this is warped and this, and it's also not being given the amount of time that it needs to breathe, to actually go through the process and the motions. And I really wanted to push to have a midwife consultant, an intimacy coordinator, and a whole team of HODs who were women to really push this idea of having a female-led birth on screen, so that it was really being done from that feminine gaze. Because I'd also been on productions where I'd seen birth scenes being enacted and just felt like there was extra support that needed to happen in those spaces. So I think when this opportunity came up and this idea dropped into position, it was something that all of us really wanted to push for, was not just the product of the film, but it was also everything that was around that film to make it happen. So it was like the amount that we had in the space, what it was going towards afterwards.
I mean, I do want to obviously talk a lot about your short film The Woman in the Wardrobe, but just before that, I was wondering though, do you still do all your different professions? Like, or are you very much, like, would you consider yourself a director and a writer now? Or do you still do dancing and acting and choreography still? I'm just wondering if, like, you still do all of them, or you've just sort of dedicated your time now to directing and writing full time?
I'm very much dedicating my time to writing and directing full time. I think that with dancing, choreography and acting, I feel like that's all, like, a massive melting pot of what has brought me to the space that I'm in now. And it's so funny because I think at the time there was always, I was watching a video of me as like, because the dance shows that I used to be in, they used to have, I worked since I was like 8 years old, like as a dancer. So I have like a lot of footage of me dancing as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I was watching one of them the other day. And I think that it's so interesting just to see that, I think there's so many parallels to where I'm at now with, I can see the determination mm-hmm. in that little kid, but within those like sequences that I was doing and within the performance that I was doing. But I think that now this is like my, yeah, this is like my grown-up job. This is like the grown-up version of of what I was doing when I was younger. And I'm still playing, you know, that's what's so wonderful about it, is that I feel like it's exactly the same in the fact that I'm really playing with ideas and bringing them to reality. And it's all the same stuff. And it's actually what me and my brother used to do when we were little. You know, we used to make movies together and we used to just play around and just come up with stories. And then I see also other videos of me as like a 3 or 4 year old, basically laying out all these dolls and like pretty much, you know, creating and wanting to do it on my own. So like wanting to basically just like direct all these like dolls and stuff. But like, you know, I think I've always been doing this, but just in different guises. And when I landed upon this, I, you know, started out by directing theatre. And then when I landed upon cinema, I was like, oh, this is it. Like, it was just like getting into a lovely warm bath. It was like, this is it. And yeah. it's really hard and it's uncomfortable and it's confronting and it's tricky, but it's also just completely right.
Yeah, it felt so, like the shoe fit kind of thing or whatever they say. But yeah, I like the bath metaphor as well.
Yeah, I was like Cinderella with my glass slipper on.
did you have any, or do you still have any, like particular mentors in your life that sort of have encouraged you and helped you along the way, whether that's family or colleagues or friends?
Yeah, I mean, my mom is incredible, and she's always been like, she's come to every single thing I've ever done.
Aww.
Every screen I've done, and every dance show I was ever in, and she's always been my biggest.
Number one fan.
But one fan. I think also my brother is incredible, you know, like he's always been he's an actor, so we're in the same universe and the same world, and we've done a lot of stuff together as well. You know, I directed his first play that he ever did, and we've always really pushed each other. And then I think with this specific kind of being like writer director for film and TV, my producer Sherry really unlocked my writing potential when I first started working with her a few years ago. I think also when I first, my agents are amazing as well. When I first started speaking to them, I made this short film, which I had genuinely no idea what I was doing when I was making it. I had no clue what I was creating. Mm-hmm. And it was like an animation and live action hybrid. So I wanted to make, and I still want to make, kind of things which are a little bit like this film that I made, the first one I made, had like a monster in it, and it had that kind of folky horror element to it, and it was quite outlandish and very ambitious, and I had no money, and I was doing it all myself, and I was like, okay, how do I create this like monster which I obviously can't make through like CGI or through that kind of thing? Okay, well, I'm just gonna draw it then, actually, and I'm gonna make it make sense, because this character is going to be an artist, so actually everything that he's going to see is going to be drawn. And then it kind of made this bizarre world, and I remember just thinking, like, I don't really know what I've made, and I have no clue. But when I first spoke to the agents that now represent me, but at the time they were mentoring me, they just really saw the potential in it, and like really saw this like raw, I guess, raw talent and this raw like need to communicate these stories in any artistic way that I could. So I feel so grateful that they always make me feel like my work is incredibly important, and like it's not just a, I think that a lot of the time, I don't know if other women experience this, but I definitely just feel like sometimes that my work is not like, oh, this is all just a bit pointless. Like, no one wants to hear this story. This is, and I really had to, like, because then the stories have done really well, and because the films have done well, I'm like, oh no, people do, I do have a duty to do this. And I think also the, you know, my first ever job that I got out of university, I worked as a director's assistant on The Crown.
Yeah.
And my director during that was so generous with me, and just, I really hadn't done much at all when I got onto that set. I'd never been on a professional set before, and never something obviously that high end. And being in that environment, and he just shared it with me. You know, when somebody just, like, there's no barriers, there's no, like, oh, you can come into this, but you can't come into that. Like, he just,
yeah, there's no, what's the expression? Like, gatekeeping kind of thing.
There's no gatekeeping. He just opened the door.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Went, this is what it's like to be a director on a high-end TV show. And has continued to support me after I left that job. And come to all of my shows, all of my screenings, like, been really, really supportive. So, I have a kind of hickledy-pickledy group of people from all different areas of my artistic journey who have always been, like, huge advocates for me. And I just, yeah, I like to keep those, it's rare to find those people, so I just like to keep them very close and
Have
them in as much as possible.
So, I mean, yeah, you mentioned The Crown there, and I was going to ask about that, so I'll ask about that now. But I'm wondering, yeah, how did that opportunity come about, and what kind of sort of key lessons and takeaways did you get from working on such a high profile project? You know, has it influenced your own work? And, you know, because obviously it's a major Netflix series. I don't know if it started out before on the BBC. I think it's always been on Netflix, hasn't it?
I think it's always on Netflix.
And yeah, so it's such a major production and very, very popular, you know, as popular as like Downton Abbey, but, you know, kind of in the same kind of, let's say, like, genre. But yeah, I'm wondering, yeah, what that experience brought you overall.
I think that for me, when I was so enthusiastic when I got onto that set, and felt incredibly lucky, which, you know, I should have done, to be in an environment that was so high profile when I really just come out of school. I still feel so grateful for that now. I think really what it gave me was an understanding that I actually, when I was saying before, like with my first, because I made two films before that, but it was during COVID, so it's, you know, it was literally me with a camera making my own films and doing absolutely everything. And somehow, you know, still getting them into festivals and stuff, because I was like, I don't know, because it, you know, very much just like I put absolutely everything into my projects, so I probably made them for probably £50 each.
Wow.
But I think getting onto that set, I realized that I actually had known what I was doing when I was making my short films. All of my instincts had been right. So because I hadn't gone to film school, you know, I'd gone to RADA, so I was working very much in a theatre capacity. I knew what I was doing with plays. I knew exactly how to approach a play. I knew how to work with actors in a theatrical space. And then I think I'd been starting to experiment with what that would be like in cinema, because I'd always wanted to work in cinema. I'd really fallen in love with cinema when I was in France and started to... It sounds really stupid, but because I think I've been in such a dance world and then I just stepped into the acting world, I really didn't know that, like, women directed films. And I know that sounds really stupid because...
No, I mean, I didn't know there was many either before I started this podcast.
I also, all of my directors that I'd ever worked with, all of my choreographers I'd ever worked with had been men. So I never thought that, like, women did that. And when I started to understand that when I was in France and I was being exposed to all these, like, amazing foreign films and, you know, just going to the cinema loads and loads and loads, just being more aware that that was the case. And also had a massive feminist awakening when I was in France as well, because one of my friends, who's like she's a feminist academic, she's me, like, a ton of books and loads of articles, and I was just like, I just went hyper nerdy and just had this massive awakening whilst I was in the middle of this like town in France. I was like, oh my God.
I was going to ask, like, off topic, but like, well, not off topic, but I mean, maybe not necessary for the podcast, but what part of France were you in?
I was in Fontainebleau.
Is that a town? I thought that was the name of the school.
It's like a tiny, tiny little town. Just, I think it's Paris.
Okay.
I hardly went to Paris. That's the thing, is that I went, now I go a lot more, like, because a lot of my friends, we were so busy when we were at that drama school that we had no opportunity to really go to Paris. And then I started escaping there in the last term. We had a teacher who kind of told us off, all of us, and was like, why haven't you all been going to Paris? Like, like a visiting teacher. And she was like, Paris will give you so much. Like, it will artistically give you so much. And so every weekend, I just committed myself to, like, going to Paris and just wandering around and flaneuring.
And flanny.
And just, like, you know, yeah, just coming across lots of different galleries and kind of just really just playing with...
I mean, good advice from the teacher, I'd say. Paris is definitely, like London or any other kind of big city, it's a great place to go for just feeling inspired. Like, you can just, like, people watch, you know, and you'll feel inspired, like, in terms of fashion and architecture and art as well. It's got a lot going on there, and cinema, of course.
And bakeries
and cheese. Those are most important.
I think that, I can't even remember what I was saying, but...
Sorry, we've gone off track with asking you where you were in France.
Oh, it's lovely. I was just thinking of baguettes then, and then I was like, what I was talking about.
I mean, I know I live in France, but I don't actually... I mean, I try not eat baguettes too much, because it could become, like, an addiction, so I kind of save it for treats now, you know, like, or...
I get that. I think this is the thing, is that when you're visiting, it's just like, give me all the baguettes, like, everything.
Yeah.
When you live there, it's like, okay, I just actually need to, like, just be normal.
Yeah.
And then...
Although, but for the locals here, it's like, it's the same as, like, I don't know, drinking a glass of water. Like, they have to have a baguette a day, or even more than one a day. It's like breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they'll be baguette alongside their food.
It's like, when I arrived in Fontainebleau, I remember, like, arriving there on my first night, and I was like, oh, it's not going to be all the cliches. Like, it's not... Literally, there were so many people, like, cycling around with, like, onions around their necks, or, like, around their necks or whatever. Like, people were wearing berets. Everyone was wearing, like, stripy shirts. I was like, what is this place? Like, this is hilarious. But it was probably, like, all of the visiting people who were doing that.
Oh, right, maybe.
It was a really, I don't know, it really, really allowed me to fall in love with cinema, because it was just, honestly, the only form of entertainment that we had away from our own rehearsals, which were so intense. And so after rehearsals, I'd just be like, I've got to go to the cinema. And the tickets were so cheap as well. It was like, you know, €3 or whatever.
Well, you're cheaper then, probably.
Yeah, it was great. And there was a really beautiful little local cinema which played loads of international films. And so I just used to go and escape there. And I really saw that, like, women could make amazing cinema. And so I was really, really intrigued about what that would be like for me. But I remember just really tantalizing with the idea of it. But then when I went to Raja and I started directing, and I was like, oh my God, this is what I should have been doing for my whole life. I absolutely love this. This is the best thing ever. And I fall into it so easily. I just absolutely love it. And and then I was like, I wonder what this is like in the cinema realm for me. And so I think being on The Crown, to be honest, was just a confirmation that was totally right, because all of my instincts, even though I wasn't calling the shots at all with anything, I was watching, I was observing, I was given a lot more responsibility, and then I think I probably warranted from my job title, just because I was so enthusiastic to be in the space, and I loved working with the actors. I loved talking to, you know, these seasoned cinematographers and, like, you know, production designers and people that had worked on films which I'd grown up watching and was, you know, I remember going, I was in Spain at one point, because we were filming abroad for a certain amount of it, and I remember being with one of the art directors, and she was, and we were talking about lots of different things, and I was saying that, you know, I've also done a bit of animation as well, and she was like, oh yeah, I love doing both animation and live action, like, I love working in both spaces. And she said, and I said, oh, what kind of things have you done? And she was like, oh, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas, and I really, like, fell off my chair. I was like, what? And then she was like, oh yeah, Apple Sprite. And I was like,
wow.
I was seriously having, I was seriously kind of artistically starstruck. You contributed to my entire childhood. And just like the photographer that I was working with, Adriano Goldman, who was just incredible, had, done Jane Eyre and I was obsessed with that film.
I mean, yeah, you're really in a sort of like a candy shop equivalent of a film set. You know, you could like, you had so much, to choose from, information and advice and inspiration to gain from being there.
I think also watching something which is so excellent being made, and actually, and this is not like a, this is just filmmaking generally, this is not like a talking down to the production in any way, like it's really messy. It's really sometimes really DIY as well, and kind of going, it actually gave me the knowledge and the ability to look at it and go, I can do this. This is possible for me to do, because it isn't this kind of, gods don't make films, human beings make films. And that was so wonderful for me to actually like ground myself in that space and be like, this is a human job. Like, we really have to just be hard grafters to be able to make this work. And so I felt like I was with my people when I was there. Really. And so it just pushed me on further. It just gave me more determination and more knowledge that it was possible for me to do it, really.
Yeah, definitely. So, I think you know sometimes if you watch a film, and of course when it's all wrapped up at the end, like in a bow at the end, it's all finished and done, it does look like the seamless perfect thing sometimes. Even sometimes if it's not, a film can still not be, or I'm sure in some directors' eyes they'll watch a film and they might think, maybe I would have changed that if I could now, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's while they're actually making it, it's still very much like a military operation where it's all organized, but also things can go wrong and things can change and maybe not as perfect as you think it is. It's not, like you said, it's not gods making films, although it might seem like it sometimes when you watch a film and you think, wow, how did they do that? But yeah, it's just humans doing a very hard job.
Yeah, just seeing it deconstructed, I think, was so important for me, seeing all the elements that go into it. And also just like seeing the job that I wanted to do firsthand, watching a director go through the entire process of, and obviously it was on a very, high level that we had the luxury of being able to have kind of 9 weeks of prep, and then having, I think we did like 4 or 5 months of filming or something for 2 episodes, and then obviously had like a certain amount of time for the edit, and just seeing like how long that entire process takes and the amount of effort that it requires, the amount of passion and determination. And it's more just me going, oh yeah, I can do that. Like, I know that I made all that, which is great. And seeing, everybody just see the way that the art is made in film and in TV and understanding.
I hope you're enjoying the conversation with Ruby so far. We'll be right back after this quick break. So I want to talk more about your short film, The Woman in the Wardrobe, which portrays childbirth in the midst of a war zone. And as you were saying earlier, which I was going to bring up, but your mum is a midwife and you also worked as a maternity care assistant for the NHS. I'm wondering where that came in exactly amongst all the doing the dancing and the choreography, but I mean, you seem to manage to do a lot of things, which is amazing. But I'm wondering, what was it exactly from this experience that inspired you to make this film in this way?
Yeah, I slotted that little journey when I was actually living in France. So every time, and also when I was at drama school, I would come back in the holidays and go and work on the ward. And I had it, I had it as kind of a flexible side job for a good 2 or 3 years, and I loved working with my mom. I knew that I was not meant to work in the health service or to be a midwife. I'm like, I'm much, much more comfortable with like fake blood and fake stories, things that aren't real.
Yeah.
And like just the emergencies and stuff, just not my thing. But I was so respectful of my mom, and also just fighting for, I think it planted a seed in me where I was like so sick of seeing women not having autonomy over their bodies and over their own birthing experiences as well. And yeah, just I think being in that environment, which I have to say, I find it very interesting that I find it very similar to, and my mum said this as well, because my mum worked on, she was on set for The Woman in the Wardrobe, and we both think that set and being on like a ward are so similar. And I think it's because both are modeled on the army,
right?
Like on, you know, for film sets, it's, you say shooting because it's completely modeled on on the army. And the same thing with maternity wards and with just hospital wards in general. It's always been that kind of military operation, and so they've got a lot of the, there's a lot of crossover with the jargon. There's a lot of similar energy. And I think that, again, a lot of those spaces, although maternity is a female dominated and led profession, it's also a lot of the time dictated by obstetricians and by doctors. And similarly with film, they're very like hyper masculine environments, even though we're telling, and I don't mean masculine as in men, I mean as in like the energy of it, you know, they telling very like vulnerable human stories. And similarly with like a maternity ward, you're facilitating something which is so pure and which is the beginning of life, and it's some of, a lot of the time, like the most memorable moments of people's lives, and in so many different capacities, you know, whether it's amazing or whether it's really difficult, and everybody has such a unique experience. And so I think for me, it just opened up an area which I had no idea. At the time, I was like, I don't know what this is doing for me at all. I'm just going along to this and I'm helping people and I'm having this very different experience, but I have no idea how this is contributing to like a wider, you know, thing for me. I don't know where this kind of comes into my journey. And it was really, I think it was just very confronting at the time, because it was also like I was then wrestling with like, oh my God, do I ever want to go through this experience in my life? Because this feels very frightening for me, like, you know, watching this myriad of different birthing experiences like every single day just felt kind of crazy. It felt amazing at some moments that I was like, wow, my body could potentially do this at some point. And then there were other moments where I was like, I never want to put my body in that situation.
Yeah, I have the exact same, I don't know how long I've had those anxieties for, but ever since I was aware that I could do that, I've thought about it and thought like, I don't know if my body's capable of that. I'm sure that's a thing that goes through all mothers' minds though.
Yeah, I think even when, you know, when you are, when you probably after you've done that, you're like, how did I
do that?
I think that it's it really made me very fascinated about birth. And then I think when I saw it depicted in TV and film after that, I suddenly felt like there was being such a disservice done to it in a way. Because, you know, and I'd read lots of stories about like in particular TV programs and in films and stuff, they didn't have like a midwife on set, but they'd have like a nurse on set. And I was like, there's something different with having a midwife there, someone who's like an expert in that field. And like, I know that, you know, my mom is, she's traveled around the entire world helping women give birth. She worked in India when she was younger. She's worked in a birthing farm in Tennessee. Like, she's just done the most incredible things in her career, and I'm in such admiration for her and the way that she's fought for women's body autonomy. And, you know, I have these distinct memories of when I was younger, like going out on protest marches with her for the right for women to be able to breastfeed their babies in public. And she used to make like badges and stuff so that we'd wear them. She put them on my coats and stuff, so we'd like go to school with like these breastfeeding, like,
I love that.
And stuff. But I've grown up in a house of like ceramic pelvises and just listening to people talking about birth all the time. So I think it's natural that it would seep into my work. And I think it's also doing the work now with the United Nations, like after the film, I realised that women's reproductive rights are at the core of equality, of fighting for equality and fighting for the ownership over our own bodies, which is ultimately when we're fighting for equality, gender equality, that is what we are trying to get, is the ownership over our own stories, over our own narratives, over our own bodies, over what we do with our bodies, how we conduct ourselves in the world, that we don't feel a threat. It's like a gateway to everything else.
Mm.
And I think that birth is very much that. I've found anyway from talking to them that that opens the conversation to so many different areas about women's sexual health and reproductive rights, and it just is the basis for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel so honoured to have like planted something into the canon, which is so unapologetically feminine, and also again is at the core of that, of my larger message, which I think is probably running throughout most of my work and will continue to run through my longer form work as well, which is really women just taking back ownership over their own stories and then also transforming within that space. Because I've always tried to look through my work and be like, what is it that I'm fascinated by? Like, what is it about? And it's not just like, I think women's stories is too vague because it's not about that. I think it's about women's transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, even within the small microcosm of this woman being within a wardrobe, she transforms from being somebody who is giving birth to being a mother at the end. And that is like it's very intimate and it's very up close. And there is such a grand transformation within that tiny space. So
what was it with sorry to interrupt, what was it with the wardrobe that made you want to use that as, like, was it used as a metaphor, a symbol for something in particular for you by using a wardrobe?
There's so many reasons why, and I think that I'll go, so firstly, because when I was looking and just genuinely, like, the generation of this, the you know, writing of this story very much came from my anger and frustration with what's going on in the world currently at the moment, but also, like, historically, women, whenever there's war, whenever there's conflict, there's women giving birth in conflict. That doesn't stop. Women don't stop creating life. People don't stop having sex. People don't stop, you know, that doesn't finish. Women don't stop having
life goes on kind of thing. It continues.
Life goes on, and just the resources stop, so women don't have safety and dignity within that space. And so I think I was just angry, and I was also just seeing so many images of, like, the last vestiges of humanity were pieces of furniture, like sofas and bits of clothing. And I remember going to, when I was in New York, I remember going to the 9/11 exhibition and just seeing, like, a pair of shoes or, like, a bit of a building or something, and you just go, wow, they were amongst the rubble. Oh, there was life. That's what it, there was life once. And it's haunting, I think. And so I think with the wardrobe, it was a combination of, I've been reading lots of stories about women in World War II giving birth in, like, annexes, like having to silently give birth in annexes because they were, like, hiding from the Nazis.
Makes me think of the film A Quiet Place, when she has to try and get, it's like almost a little bit like that. I've never seen such a tense moment in a film as well. And that's what your film actually kind of reminded me of, that moment in the film when Emily Blunt, or not sure the name of the character, but yeah, she's in the bath, and it's like, how are you supposed to do that in silence?
That's very flattering, because I love that film. I think that there's something also about the fact that when I was working on the maternity ward, like, we'd give women these, like, big birthing rooms with, like, a pool and, like, or, you know, a lovely bed and, like, all of these candles and stuff, and they'd end up, like, you know, burying down in, like, in the adjoining bathroom or something, and, like, giving birth in, like, the tiny corner of the room, and you're like, what? But they, you know, there's something about being in a space of safety, being kind of cradled in, like, a nest, and I think that's just really instinctive, like, that's really instinctual for people to do that when they're in, like, a birthing space. I also think that the wardrobe for me represents a midwife in the absence of one, like a vicarious midwife in the absence of one. It kind of protects Nadia and her baby from what's going on outside, and keeps them safe and keeps them warm and keeps them intimate. But it also was a space for, me and the actress Afsana, she's incredible, she's just an amazing actress, and we worked so closely together on building an entire backstory for this character. So we wrote, like, I think we've written a book. We wrote a massive story for her.
It could be a feature then, potentially.
But I didn't want it to be just this random woman giving birth. I wanted it to, even though we've only got 7 minutes of footage, I wanted it to feel like it had so much more depth to it. There was layers and layers and layers to unpick, and it could work like multiple watches. And I just wanted to give her, yeah, just a history and a background, and also to give Afsana something to really dive into and to really wrestle with. And I think it, you know, it definitely worked because we got such an incredible performance out of her.
Yeah,
she gave
absolutely.
So much. I think that the wardrobe was such a perfect place because it was also, we attached it to her, to this character's sisters and her mum, and we were able to have all these pieces of clothing hanging in the wardrobe, which were pieces that then we kind of sprayed with perfume, and we were like, these are her mum's clothes, or like, these are her sisters, this is her sister's scarf, and just things that were like attached to her family. So she felt like, even though her family weren't there, and even though she was completely alone, she had this almost like this female ancestral lineage kind of protecting her throughout this experience. And she had all the people around her that she wanted to have around her, even though they weren't there in person, they were kind of there in spirit and in history. And I think that is like a thing that happens, you know, when you give birth, is that you're, you know, there's so many women throughout history who have been through that's it. There's women everywhere right now giving birth, and it's like you tap into this collective energy of like,
I know what you mean, yeah, like an energy of it all happening around the world kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. And so I think that it was a similar thing, that even though she was locked inside, that she locks herself inside this wardrobe, even though she creates this nest for herself, and she's very frightened, and she's, you know, very vulnerable in this moment as well. So a moment,
but ultimately she's not alone, like, really. I mean, we feel like we're with her kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. And I wanted to feel like we were really getting underneath her skin, and that we were going on a journey with her through her breathing and through her contractions. And I think actually some of the most interesting moments in the film for me, now that I've got over the fact that at the time when I was editing it, you know, I was watching it like 8 or 9 times a day, and I was like, I've got some distance from it now, which is lovely. Like, now I can actually watch it objectively. But some of my favourite moments in the film are the moments in between the contractions, the moments where she's resting and gathering herself for the building up to the last moment of contractions, where she's got moments with the material, where she's connecting with her sisters and her ancestors and people that she used to. We developed this whole story about her basically playing inside the wardrobe with her sisters when she was younger, and having kind of like, you know, female meetings in there with her sisters and stuff like that. And I think that she connects to those moments in between the contractions, and those moments are really special for me.
Yeah, like the writing on the wall of the,
yeah, exactly.
The wardrobe.
Yeah, those are her sister's initials that they all carved into the wall together, and I made sure that the production designer put those into the space, and then we just ended up filming them on the day because I was like, I really love them, and I think it's really important to kind of, even though as an audience you might not necessarily know what that is, it's like there's a history. And then I think ultimately, you know, she brings a daughter into the world, and she brings like a piece of hope into this broken universe, and that's really, yeah, just adding like another woman to the lineage.
I mean, with current news, I mean, very recent news, yesterday's news, which I think you know what I'm talking about, but, you know, these kind of stories and women's, you know, reproductive rights feel so, like, more poignant than ever. And for this particular film, you collaborated with the UN to fundraise for emergency birthing kits. And so I have sort of two questions here, is that, do you think that storytelling in film can really help make a change? And if so, what advice? I mean, I think it can, if clearly you've managed to partner up with the UN to do something about it, to do, you know, to make a change. But also, what is your advice for filmmakers that want to do something similar to what you've done here, you know, partnering with a humanitarian organisation and ultimately setting up something that is going to make a change, and not just something for people to watch and consume? It's actually got like a domino effect after it.
Yeah, I 100% think that film can make a massive difference and a massive change. And I think there's so much space for, I was actually at the House of Lords last week and just talking to, you know, civil organizations and to, and I was with UNFPA, so I was, they were hosting an event and they had a lot of like, you know, current MPs who have pretty much, you know, haven't just been elected, but obviously they've been on like summer recess and stuff, so it feels like they're just coming into their roles, recently elected MPs, and just hearing them talking about women's reproductive rights and speaking to people. And cinema is so powerful because I think it carries that human story element, and you can start, I think it's so important to have all this data and have all the statistics to support that, but I think ultimately if you don't have a human story, it just becomes numbers, it just becomes a number game, and actually it doesn't wake people up. I think that what is really exciting about what we've done with this film is that when we played it in front of our first audience, which was like a private screening that we had, it was a real mix of like cinema people, and then we had people from the kind of humanitarian aid sector, we had people from the academic sector. We tried to really push this kind of co-audience, like this, just a really like an audience that could consume it, see the artistry within it, but also could actually physically do something about it policy wise. And I think that's always been our mission, and that was really what the activist in residence position gave me with this, because this was originally funded by the Feminist Center for Racial Justice, and our conversation with them at the very beginning of that position was that this would go towards pushing, I said like pushing policy change or pushing, and I was very much blue sky thinking, and then I think ultimately like it has happened, which is really exciting that we are having those conversations and that we're pushing that forwards, and we're actually doing another screening in December as part of the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. Finding places where the film can really coexist with the statistics, with the data, and with the ultimate message of making sure that women have aid around reproductive rights, and women have, I think, just opening up a conversation about it as well, and bringing human story element that, you know, makes people weep a little bit, wakes people up, makes people loosen their ties. You know, it's, I think that it's got a lot of heart in it, this film, and it's got so much hope planted into it as well. And I think that all of the, all of those elements, you know, we have a statistic from the UNFPA right at the end of the film. And I think that the model we've been trying to use is that we get people to engage with this really intimate story. We then talk about the statistics, and then, which, you know, upset people, obviously, because it's a really difficult thing to face. And then afterwards, it's like, but there is so much hope because we are doing this and this, and actually £4 you can donate to a birthing kit which will save an emergency birthing kit, which will not just save one life, but it will save two, will save a mother and a child. And it's so simple, and I actually now take the birthing kits with me to all the talks that I do, and just show people what's inside them, because it's, you know, it's the price of a coffee, and it can save lives. And the UNFPA are doing incredible things. They're training midwives. They are, you know, in spaces of humanitarian crisis, they have these birthing, like mobile birthing units, where they kind of go around and they kind of do prenatal and postnatal checks on people in spaces where they wouldn't necessarily get access to that kind of healthcare. They also do birthing buckets as well, which can then be used afterwards to carry water and to and as trays for food and stuff. So they're really like, they're so innovative and really exciting. I think, as you said, like looking at what happened yesterday, I just really, with Trump, I feel more than ever that this work is so incredibly important, and I feel so honoured that we have a piece of, I said it before, you know, I feel so honoured that I can like plant something into the cinematics, which is fighting for something which is so important right now. But this is not going to stop being important. This is always going to be essential, because women are always going to be giving birth, and as long as there is inequality, this is going to be something which is a secondary issue, and we want to make it a fundamental issue, because it's the start of everything. It's just so fundamentally important to our larger fight for equality. And so I feel like, I think people that want to do something similar, and I gave a talk about activism in filmmaking at the Women Without Borders Film Festival a couple of weeks ago, and just getting to talk about the fact that the reason that this has been, I think, so successful in the way that it's part, you know, it's collaborating now with the United Nations, and we've got a lot of interest, and people have been really excited about it. The reason that is the case is because me and my producer Sherry are so deeply passionate about the subject matter, and I think we will not stop fighting for it to be seen, and for the conversation to be had, and for our voices to be heard, and for this story to be told ultimately. And so excited that actually the donations have gone up so much since we started working with the United Nations. It's just brilliant. So I think evidence-wise, cinema can make a massive change, which is really exciting. Definitely. So we've proved our theory.
Definitely, you've proved the theory. And it's ultimately like a call to action. And as you say, it's first you're presented with the story, so you're given almost like a real-life experience or an example, something to sort of provoke that emotion and make you realise about something maybe you didn't know. And then afterwards, you know, providing you with the information and statistics, and then something to do about it, basically, if it, you know, if you feel so inclined, you want to help, sort of thing. And I think that's great that it sort of.
I think that's the model, isn't it? For people who really want to embark on that journey or would really like to do that, I think that's the model, is find something that you're incredibly passionate about, like this deep within your gut that you've always wanted to talk about, something that's really personal as well, and you have never-ending enthusiasm for. Because every time I kind of feel like, oh my god, I'm running to the end of my my energy or whatever, it's like I have conversations like I'm having with you right now, and I'm like, I'm never gonna run out of energy.
No. The passion is the fire is there, it's too strong, kind
of
thing.
The hearth is always raging, and I think that's so important to be like, okay, I'm gonna fight for this like tooth and nail. Then I think finding a story or generating a story which is connected to that, which feels like it could be put on screen, and finding something that's really urgent as well. I think this story felt so urgent. We have, me and Sherry, my producer, have so many projects that we have in the pipeline, and then this one just literally came out of nowhere, and we were like, oh, this is the one that has to happen right now. This has to happen right now. This is so urgent. And I, you know, I wish it wasn't, but it is. And
I mean, what's the alternative? We just sort of shrug our shoulders and put up with things. Like, that's a bit, I mean, it's, I just think that would be a shame, really. Do you know what I mean? So it's better to do, to contribute your little part that you can.
Yeah, utilize what we have as well. Utilize the fact that we utilize our storytelling to be able to do something. I think it's and then I think finding the charities and finding the humanitarian aid and things that it can go towards that feel like they really align with your project. So I think with the United Nations, we did a kind of, my the people at the Feminist Center for Racial Justice did like a background check on like lots of different charities and and really pointed us towards specific people that they thought were really great to have a chat with. And then again, the fire ignited, and I just rang the head of UNFPA because I was like, I just need to like get, I need to get to the top. Like, I need to get in conversation with like the person who's gonna kind of okay this. And like, and luckily, Monica, who is the head of the UNFPA in London, she has an equal amount of fire as I do. And it's also very crazy, crazy passionate. So it's been a real, like, a kindred spirit moment where we kind of, you know, there's, it's, she's obviously very incredibly respectable, very, very formal, but there's also, like, this raw energy, which I feel like just very much play off of each other. And it's very blue sky thinking. There's no, there's no glass ceiling. It's like we can go, we can push.
I think that's what you need. You need people around you that have got the same kind of passion as you, and obviously are willing to give you some critical, what's it called, constructive criticism if need be, but also people that are like, believe in you and believe that anything is possible kind of thing.
And a slightly delusional as well.
I was going to say, and a bit delulu, a bit of slightly delusional people that are like, nothing is too crazy.
I mean, look, if Trump can become president,
oh,
and he's convicted,
anything,
you know,
is possible.
Then anything is possible.
Oh, so, yeah, definitely. Yeah. It would seem so. Yeah. But just the last few questions. I've wrote down so many that we haven't even gone over, but, like, I can't have a four-hour podcast. I mean, I could, but it would just be a hell to edit. So the last few questions. So you mentioned you're working on some projects with...
Sherry,
yeah. Sherry, sorry. So, yes, you're working on some new future projects with your producer, Sherry, and which includes your first feature called Viper and another one called Hungry Girls. Can you tell me in a nutshell a bit more about these projects, if you can share anything so far?
Yeah, I mean, they're very much, like, in the...
Pre-production stage.
Yeah, like, we're finding our people at the moment, really. So we've got some, yeah, exciting pieces of work underway. And, yeah, just, I can't say too much.
Okay.
But we are, yeah, we're very excited about them. And it's, again, very much following on from the themes of, you know, female transformation and reclaiming body autonomy. And in a kind of genre, very, like, hyper-genre space. So I feel really, really excited about them. But, you know, these things just take a while to be able to...
Yeah.
I actually wrote Viper, like, 2 years ago. So, yeah, coming up to 2 years, it was... I shut myself away and hibernated one winter and just wrote Viper. And I'm obsessed with it and have been for a very long time. But I think it's, like, finding the perfect people to tell the story alongside me. So it's just about gathering. And I think that's why also doing short films is so wonderful, because it's like you start to gather people that you're like, oh, okay, yeah, we'll do work together. And it's, and you're making the work, just you're heightening everything that is happening. And so I think it's just holding on to those people when they come along, really. And
yeah, like picking your team and your crew, like your tribe or your troop or whatever you call it. But yeah, I mean, yeah, in some situations you see certain directors working with the same actors or the same people, and, like, they do keep, you know, hold of certain people their whole careers. I interviewed, before last year, I interviewed Carol Spear, who's been the production designer for David Cronenberg for, like, his whole career, basically. And, like, yeah, when you do find that good relationship, like, you hold on to it. Like, if the team works, no, what's the expression? Like, it's actually an expression in French that I'm thinking of, and they say that we don't change a team that works or something like that. Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, so last few questions. Have you got any current films that you're loving lately or that you've really loved lately? Maybe we could actually turn this into a little Instagram post where I usually share, like, my recent guest, like, top five films or something.
Ooh.
But if
oh
you have any
God.
On the
I
top of your head.
And then
oh, yeah, your top four. Is it four on Letterboxd,
yeah.
Not five?
Yeah, I've got my top four on Letterboxd. I knew that there was a reason why I had done this. I think that my... Let me just log into it.
I'm technically stealing their job, though. They're the ones that usually do the video asking, what are your four favourites? Anyway.
I know we've only got... Here, my favourite films. Do you want to hear my four favourites?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Titanic.
Oh,
I'm
my God. I love it.
I just think, so I'm not going to, like, these are, you know, I'm not going to go, like, hyper artistic. These are, like, my favourite films ever. Mm. Like, I could just watch them over and over again. Titanic, I think, is such a complete film. It is just everything. It's a romance. It's an action film. Mm. I respect any director who brings a mass amount of water into... any set and has so many extras. I just think that is just so admirable.
A lot to manage. Oh, it was one of my first favourite films as well, so.
Yeah. Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. I think it's such a complete film. I'm obsessed. I would go for the third one as well because I love it, but the Yule Ball steals it for me. And then I also think having Voldemort at the end and the darkness of it, I just love. I'm such a Harry Potter fan, so...
I was more Twilight, but I'm trying to remember what happened in Goblet of Fire and I honestly couldn't tell you, but I think my favourite's probably, like, the first or something, but yeah.
Yeah, it's the Triwizard Tournament. It's, like, all of the kind of... It's so epic. I just adore it. Coraline, I'm obsessed.
I have not seen this.
Love, love. Coraline. It's amazing. It's so dark and scary. And I watched it as a kid and I was like, I adore this. Mm. And I love Leica as a company as well. They do gorgeous stop motion animation. Mm. And they've really, you know, Trevor Knight like really pushes the boundaries of having technology involved in stop motion as well. So I just think it's beautiful. I'm so obsessed with the vibe of it. I have, mm-hmm. these are all my like 5-star films. I'm like, I can't fault them.
Yeah.
Cabaret mm-hmm. as well. The Bob Fosse film, mm-hmm. I just think is stunning. I'm obsessed with it. And I remember watching it the first time and I was like, that's a perfect film. I just love it. I think it's wonderful. So those are my top four.
Amazing.
I've got a musical, I've got an animation, I've got Harry yeah. Potter, a big Hollywood epic. So I
a bit like... of everything. I mean, yeah, like, I think ultimately it's not always about, like, the... It's what, you know, the films that have meant most to you kind of thing as well and that resonate most with you.
I also love Daisies as well, which mm-hmm. is a film, if I'm just plugging, like, a female director, mm-hmm. Vera Kotelova, who is a Czech filmmaker, and it's a 60s film about these two women who basically, they're just really badly behaved and they just mm-hmm. go around and, like, do... naughty things around the world, and they kind of like go out with like all these old men, and the old men like buy them dinner, and they like eat loads and loads of food, and then they just kind of like run away from the old men and stuff like that. It's so funny, and it's just so experimental and wonderful, and I love that film so much, just for the sheer like just the fact that they experiment so much. Mm. I think it's just insane.
But you've got something for everyone there, which is yes. great, I think. yes, also, like, Coraline's kind of like, you were saying, you like, you know, The Corpse Bride and Nightmare Before Christmas. Coraline, for me, feels almost like, you know, the vibes are very much Tim Burton, kind of like similar.
I love goth kind of. Edward Scissorhands, I'm obsessed with.
Ah,
as well.
Yeah, I love that as well. I'll have to add a couple of those to my watch list. And lastly, what would be like your sort of last bit of advice for anyone, you know, wanting to do to move into a similar sort of career like you?
Just make something however you can. Don't let money or gatekeepers stop you from making. Just make something, if it's on your phone, if it's on a rubbishy little camera, like anything. Just keep creating, keep writing.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of The Real Girls Club. A huge thank you to Ruby for sharing her inspiring journey and the impactful story behind The Woman in the Wardrobe. Be sure to subscribe, leave a review and leave a rating. And also you can follow us on Instagram at Real Girls Club. I'll be back next month with a new episode. So until then, have a lovely day. Thank you.